You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, and for Cynthia Canty. Think back to grade school. Remember that one kid who was disrupting the class, talking out of turn, cracking jokes, didn't seem to understand how to behave appropriately in class, always getting sent to the principal's office? A troublemaker. There's a new book called Troublemakers, Lessons in Freedom from Young Children at School. The author is Carla Shalaby. She's a research specialist at the School of Education at the University of Michigan, and she joins us now. These troublemakers in your book, Zora, Lucas, Sean, and Marcus, I mean, we really get to know these kids, know their teachers, even know their families. And by the way, I think at least three of them might make good journalists because they pursue information doggedly. How'd you find these kids?
These kids are never really that hard to find, and you can find at least one in every single kind of classroom in every single kind of school. But I work in teacher education, and so I have the great privilege of being in classrooms all over the country and all over the place and often, which even teachers don't really get the privilege of seeing so many different kinds. And so I was working supporting new teachers in those classrooms, and of course, those students stand out everywhere I go. And so I was drawn to them while just doing classroom observations of the student teachers who were actually placed in their rooms. But they came recommended by their teachers. Their teachers were asked for students who just seemed to, like you said, just kind of doggedly pursue their own interests.
The one thing I wasn't clear about is how long were you in those classrooms?
Yeah, so it was about a full year with a couple of them a little bit longer than that. And so, of course, as you know from reading the book, it was seeing them both in school, but trying to see them outside of school as much as possible as well. So at their karate classes and baseball practice and all of their out of school time.
And even went into therapy sessions with the families sometimes. I think it would be difficult for most of us to view these kids from your perspective. I mean, you have a lot of empathy for these kids, but you know, their behavior is irritating. I mean, really, really disruptive. How was it that you were able to look beyond that and get to the point that you believe they're like caged birds who need to fly, need to sing?
I think there are a couple of ways. One, I think I have quite a bit of empathy for them just in terms of the way that I was positioned in a school as well. So when I was a school teacher, I often felt like the troublemaker, and I felt really unpleasantly sort of received by my administrators for making noise about the kinds of things that I thought were wrong. And so I already had the experience of feeling like behaviors are unwelcome when they are difficult or critical or challenging to authority. So I had empathy on that level. But the other way is that, frankly, when you're a teacher, and especially an elementary school teacher, you do learn over time to see children as full human beings. I think if you're committed to that profession, that empathy is part of, should be, part of both your training and your daily practice. So I think I was already a bit wired that way.
And we'll get a little further into that, what you just said about that, but let's deal with some other things first. I think when you have a troublemaker, the instinct, I think, among most adults is to try to minimize the disruptive behavior because you don't want the other kids to suffer. You don't want them to lose out on learning opportunities because of that one kid or a couple of kids. What do you say about that to teachers or parents of those kids who are not the troublemakers?
Yeah, that's always the hardest question because I do understand that the way we respond to troublemakers typically can mean that we're taking opportunities away from other kids. But I would say that's more about our response than it is about the troublemaking behaviors themselves. So teachers will often say, and families will often say, well, that, you know, this behavior is standing in the way of my kid's opportunity to learn. What I always say is actually that child is providing your child an opportunity to learn. Maybe not the kinds of things that we typically think are the only things that should be taught in school, but it's an opportunity to learn quite a bit about how to treat people as if they are important and how to see them and how to hear them and how to see and hear them despite behaviors that are quite unpleasant. I think that's a habit that we could all afford to learn.
In the book, there were times when it was really difficult for you to just be an observer. After all, I mean, as you mentioned, you're a former teacher. How successful were you in being close to these four kids without being an influence on them and kind of messing up your research?
You know, it's amazing because I have never felt so free in a classroom as I was as an adult who did not have a teaching responsibility. And I have to say, I'm not sure I would have been able to know these kids in the same way if I did have the responsibility for teaching them. I was able to just genuinely be curious about them and not have to try to intervene. that was just the most liberating experience. And I wish more teachers had the chance to be with the kids that they teach in a genuinely curious way without the pressure to have to move them somewhere and intervene and change them in a million different ways. And so I feel like these are the kids, of all the kids I've taught, who I know the best, as a matter of fact, because I could just wonder about them rather than having to obsess over how to change them.
Of those kids, I believe it was Marcus who really tried to draw you in, though. He was really trying to get you to some exchange with him. How did that feel?
You know, I have to tell you, I love all four of these kids, but I probably think about Marcus the most. I feel that I was the most connected to Marcus, even though actually I saw him the least out of all four of those kids as well, because he was really adept at human connection. He had a skill and a talent for it, and I just fell in love with him in a different kind of way. And so, yeah, of course, the book argues that that's the major thing that he was working for in his negative behavior. But it was, of course, hard to resist. And he's probably the one that I intervened on the most in terms of a teaching role. But he made that not optional for me. And I think for that reason, I often think about him the most.
When you describe the behavior of the kids in the classroom, it's one thing, but then you tell us about what they're like at home, and suddenly there's a big, at least for me, there was a big paradigm shift. I'm like, oh, I get this now. In what ways did their home lives help you understand them? Let's just single out one of them. For example, Zora.
Yeah. I can't begin to describe how much seeing her at home changed my view of who she was at school and helped me to understand what she was doing at school and why. And so, of course, you know, Zora is a biracial child. She's Puerto Rican and African American and is one of the very few in her school, children of color, and is positioned, you know, as really problematic for being different. And yet at home,
she's sort of a free spirit.
That's an understatement. Yeah. She loves to stand out. That is a part of who she is. And of course, school is not really a place for that. School is a place for fitting in, for
conformity,
being like,
yeah.
And well-intentioned conformity. Her teachers are really well-intentioned and cared about her quite a bit. But it was conformity with a particular way of being. And that was a white middle-class way of being that they thought was the world that they were trying to prepare her for. At home, she was being prepared quite differently for the world as her parents of color saw it. And her parents of color understood that she needed quite a bit of pride in the things that made her different. And so they played up her differentness. You know, they played up her outstandingness. And it was celebrated. And they're all really unusual people in some ways, right? They stand out. You're going to notice her parents in a room. You're going to notice her grandma.
Why? Why would you notice them?
They're amazing. They're colorful. They're bold, bright. They're loud. They are just people who are like celebrating life and are just very much awake and alive. You see them. You're just not going to miss them. But their clothes, their manner of speech, just the way that they be in the world is a noticeable way of being. And it's quite infectious, but it's very, very different than their neighbors and than all of the people who are in their very wealthy sort of neighborhood. So they stand out and they take pride in their standing out and they figure, well, we stand out here anyway as people of color in a very, very predominantly white neighborhood. We might as well sort of take it all the way. But at school, you know, that way of being was not the way. And really caused Zora quite a bit of trouble at school.
Your premise, as I understand it, is these kids, these troublemakers, are not really the problem. Actually, they're the canary in the coal mine. In what way?
They're drawing our attention to some of the invisible kinds of poisons in our classroom and school air. And so the way that I understand what they're doing is that, you know, they are refusing to accept things and to comply with things that frankly may not be good for any of the children in that room, but the other children may just be able to live with it more quietly. And so I think sometimes what's hardest for teachers is that some of the harm that we do to children is really quite invisible to us because it's well-intentioned, because we take for granted that these are things that are okay, because we know we care about kids. And so that invisibility makes those kinds of poisons really hard to intervene on. because you don't see them as a teacher. So my sense is that if a kid is really triggered by something in a classroom enough to persist on bad behavior despite all of the ways that it's going to negatively affect that child, that's drawing our attention to something. There's a trigger that we can't see that child is bold enough to respond to. And so we'd better wonder what that's a response to. And I think we wonder about that in the wrong set of ways typically. And we search for problems in the child rather than thinking, what's the trigger here in the cultural and social era of our classrooms?
And of course, the way we punish them is, Okay, you go sit at the back of the classroom, They miss out on a lesson plan. You go to the principal's office, they miss out on more schooling. You are suspended or expelled, they miss out on more schooling. That's not really helping out.
No.
So what do you suggest?
Well, it's certainly not helping that child. But to go back to your earlier question, I think it's also not helping the other children in the room. The other children are learning something from us when that is how we respond to behavior that is unusual or challenging or difficult. To exclude a person teaches the other children that person is disposable and that we can make our lives easier by just removing that person from our community. I think that is a hard lesson for the other kids to learn.
Yeah, and it sounds like incarceration, too.
Well, that is what it is. That's what it's preparation for. It's preparation for the world that we have now, which says if you do something bad, you deserve to be thrown away, and that's your choice. And that's a decision that you've made. In fact, no, that's a cultural response to transgression. And actually, we all move through the world doing harm. And we need to think about different ways to respond to the ways that we do harm, because I'm hoping that teachers understand the opportunity they have to teach for the world that we want rather than the world that we have.
Of course, we get to know some of these teachers as well.
Yes.
And all well-intentioned, as you said. But, you're kind of at the end going, okay, well, what's the lesson here? What can you do? You didn't leave teachers hanging. You offer some advice. Can you sum it up in a couple of sentences?
I tried not to leave teachers hanging, even though I know we'll probably still be somewhat dissatisfying because it is not a how-to book. Mm-hmm. And this is a book, to your earlier point around the incarceration comparison. Like, I've really been reading a lot about a movement afoot around the abolition of prisons and the abolition of police. What would a world look like if we didn't need police and we didn't need prisons? I think about that a lot, and I wonder about what are the skills that world would require? And so what would we need to be able to do in relation to each other in the imagination of a world that didn't require us to cage human beings, no matter their transgressions? I've started to try to mine that work for the actual skills that we might begin to teach young children. Different ways of being with each other that are insistent on every person mattering and no person being disposable. I think that's actually a set of relational skills that we can teach in school. Usually the response is, yeah, okay, but what about math? What about literacy, right? I think of math and literacy as, again, just tools and a set of skills that help us to imagine and to enact a different and a better and a more human world.
But the thing that we hear,
And
I've heard this several times by politicians in Lansing, is that, look, we have to train a better workforce. And that means you got to be in work on time, you got to behave a certain way at the workplace, you got to be at your machine at a certain point, and that requires rigidity. That's not what you're talking about here.
That isn't what I'm talking about. That is a description of the world we have now, where people are defined by their work and where we build schools in the image of a job market, where it's sort of every person for themselves. But, we live in a state where there are people who don't have clean water to drink, right? That's the result of that kind of model of thinking, well, it's every person for themselves and we ought not worry about throwing people away. Right. I think what I'm trying to work toward is preparing children not just for work, but for work that helps them to be in relation with each other in different kinds of ways. So we ought to not just prepare kids for work, but also prepare them to be parents, prepare them to be good partners, prepare them to be good colleagues when they're at work. Relationships with other people are not secondary to job skills. They're central to job skills.
At the back of the book, you pretty much tear into the people responsible for the state of the Detroit public schools, allowing them to deteriorate. for the threats of decertification for teachers who walked out protesting the conditions of the school, what, 2 years ago, I think
that
was,
right.
For the unfair, unequal education in these predominantly black classrooms. Why was that the last note to your readers?
Detroit is an amazing place to learn from. Because Detroit has had to figure things out. They've had to, you know, as Grace and Jimmy Lee Boggs used to say, make a way out of no way. Where there is no water, they've had to figure out how to get water to their neighbors. Where there is no food, they've had to figure out how to feed their communities. They solve problems. Detroiters solve problems. And we don't necessarily teach kids that set of skills. And so when we have teachers in our public schools who are actually mobilizing to represent kids, right? So they were mobilizing around the condition of their schools, not for more pay. Actually, they weren't being paid, right? We had run out of money to pay them. So this was a different kind of educator movement. It wasn't about, I want a better job. It was about, these kids deserve more. These kids deserve better. To punish those troublemaking teachers, right, is yet again a reflection of our typical response to people who make noise. It's just shut your mouth, keep your suffering private, every person for themselves. I think teachers ought to be trained in the image of those Detroit educators, right? We're going to make our suffering public. We're going to raise it up as a public problem. We're going to be public pedagogues. We're not going to teach privately in our classrooms. I think our kids in Detroit learned quite a lot from their teachers in those moves outside of school.
The book is Troublemakers, Lessons in Freedom from Young Children at School. The author is Carla Shalaby. Thanks for telling us about Zora, Lucas, Sean, and Marcus. I don't think your readers are going to forget them.
Thanks so much.